How could a man who started as a respected civil rights leader eventually be turned to a life of leading a cult to mass suicide? A life of twists, turns, highs, lows, and a disastrous end to not only his world, but the world of countless souls around him. This is the dark and very true story of Jim Jones on the dark side of Wikipedia.
Sometimes the human mind goes to dark places. Sometimes those dark delusions turn into reality. A reality so shaded and gray, once all is said and done, the healthy mind is drawn into the documented retelling of these tragic events, trying to find logic, reason, and understanding where there may be none at all. This is the dark side of Wikipedia.
James Warren Jones was an American civil rights preacher and faith leader turned cult leader who conspired with his inner circle to direct a mass murder-suicide of his followers in his jungle commune at Jonestown. He launched the People's Temple in Indiana during the 1950s. Reverend Jones was ordained in 1957 by the Independent Assemblies of God and in 1964 by the Disciples of Christ. He moved his congregation to California in 1965 and gained notoriety with his activities in San Francisco in the 1970s. He then left the United States, bringing many members to a jungle commune. In 1978, media reports surfaced of human rights abuses in the People's Temple in Jonestown. U.S. Representative Leo Ryan led a delegation to the commune to investigate. Ryan and others were murdered by gunfire while boarding a return flight with some former cult members who had wished to leave. Jones then ordered and likely coerced a mass suicide and mass murder of 918 commune members, 304 of them children, almost all by cyanide-poisoned Flavor-Aid. I think the obviously I'm not trying to disparage 918 people who died. I honestly didn't realize it was that high of a number, but I think one of the more humorous victims in all of this is Kool-Aid, because for all of the years after this 1978 mass, you know, suicide, the term that was constantly used was Kool-Aid surrounding Jim Jones, not Flavor-Aid, which many of us remember from the grocery store aisles as being the slightly cheaper alternative to Kool-Aid. Could have been their big marketing move, but unfortunately, this is how it ended for them. I always heard Kool-Aid, didn't you? I didn't realize it was Flavor-Aid.
Is that where they came up with the you're drinking the Kool-Aid?
Yeah, it's exactly where it came from. But Kool-Aid sounds better than Flavor-Aid and probably a little bit more well-known than Flavor-Aid. I don't know if is Flavor-Aid even still out there, or is it just like Crystal Light and Kool-Aid? And I don't know. I go to that aisle sometimes. I can't say I've seen Flavor-Aid, or it doesn't stand out to me as being there anymore.
Flavor-Aid, a non-carbonated soft drink beverage made by the Jet Cert Company in West Chicago, introduced it in 1929, sold throughout the U.S., similar to the drink mix Kool-Aid.
Is it still around?
Currently comes in cherry, raspberry, grapeberry punch, tropical punch, orange, pineapple, orange, lemonade, pink lemonade, lemon lime, mango, and kiwi watermelon flavors.
There you go. Well, now we know.
So next time you're starting a cult looking to kill 600 to 900 people, Flavor-Aid. Not Kool-Aid, but it'll still kill you.
I guess it would have been maybe he saved. It's interesting. Why did he pick Flavor-Aid over Kool-Aid at the time? That's my question. Was it a little bit cheaper when you're getting 918 doses? Like he saved $20 on this Kool-Aid?
People are frugal for many reasons, Tony. They like to save money, whether they're buying an off-brand lawnmower to cut the grass or kill people.
I think that might have been, that's the interesting thing of this whole story, is he saved about $20 to $40 on flavored drink mix by picking Flavor-Aid over Kool-Aid. Yet Kool-Aid still got the bad rap for all of eternity and always will, no matter what. I wonder what flavor it was. But it, what's interesting about his story beyond the Flavor-Aid thing that I get stuck on is I really did not know much about his history and his work that seemingly up until towards the latter portion of his life and his followers really wasn't that horrible. It was more so more of a civil rights type leader and was adopted by a lot of mainstream people as an okay guy. It was more so the last couple chapters where things got really fucking crazy. But I think that's probably how it is for a lot of folks that end up leading cults in a successful manner and getting a lot of people to follow them is you can't go out of the gates, you know, hey, let's all move to a colony in Africa. Nobody's going to sign up for that. You got to start out kind of small and kind of semi-normal. And most people are like, oh, okay, it's a religion, I guess. Then it just gets weirder and weirder as time goes by. But
it's a marathon, not a sprint.
Yeah.
You got to baby step slowly into mind screwing all of your members.
Baby Steps is a great book, by the way. It's by an author who he lives has a lake cottage out by Lake Winnipesaukee, I believe. He was on Good Morning America several years ago. And I think his house got blown up by a patient of his named Bob something. But his book was called Baby Steps. Do you recall that?
No, but I'm looking up and see, that's why he wrote the book.
You know what I'm talking about?
To run before.
Do you know what I'm referencing?
His house got blown up.
I'm referencing What About Bob? So it's not real.
See, here's the thing. There are some of those jokes that there's 10 people in a room, mm-hmm. right? 9 of them, the joke goes over their head. They almost feel kind of dumb.
Yeah.
But then you just hit the 10th person, and they are crapping themselves laughing so hard.
Yeah.
It was a great joke. And I have seen What About Bob. I saw What About Bob probably 25 years ago, last time I saw it.
Oh, it's one of those like I watch almost on a yearly basis. It's one of my favorite movies. So when you make the reference to it, there was a lot of people going, oh, my God, he's talking about What About Bob, and he doesn't get it. So, yeah. So there you go. Yeah. Lake Winnipesaukee, Baby Steps, What About Bob? But I forget what Richard Dreyfuss's character's name was.
Dr. Leo Marvin.
Yep, Dr. Leo Marvin. And he's walking around. That was a great movie. Anyway, if you're looking for a nice escape movie from all the shit going on in our world right now, and you can have 2 hours of just laugh and this is funny, What About Bob? It's a
Bill
winner.
Murray, yeah. Richard Dreyfuss, yeah. 1991.
Great movie. Continuing on with our story here today, on a not-so-lighthearted note, the story of Jim Jones as it continues here on the dark side of Wikipedia. Jones was born on May 13th, 1931, in a rural area of Crete, Indiana, to James Thurman Jones, a World War I veteran, and Lynetta Putman. Jones was of Irish and Welsh descent. He later claimed partial Cherokee ancestry through his mother, but his maternal second cousin said this was untrue. Economic difficulties during the Great Depression led the family to Lynn, Indiana in 1934, where Jones grew up in a shack without plumbing. Jones was a voracious reader who studied Stalin, Marx, Mao, Gandhi, and Hitler. He also developed an intense interest in religion. One writer suggested this was primarily because he found it difficult to make friends. Childhood acquaintances recalled him as a really weird kid who was obsessed with religion and death. They alleged that he frequently held funerals for small animals on his parents' property and that he had stabbed a cat to death. Jones and a childhood friend both claimed his father was associated with the Ku Klux Klan, which had gained a stronghold in Depression-era Indiana. Jones recounted how he and his father clashed on the issue of race and how he did not speak with his father for many, many years. After he refused to allow one of Jones' black friends into the house, Jones' parents separated and Jones moved with his mother to Richmond, Indiana. In December of 1948, he graduated from Richmond High School early with honors. Jones married nurse Marcelin Baldwin in 1949, and they moved to Bloomington, Indiana. She died with him in Jonestown. He attended Indiana University in Bloomington, where he was impressed with a speech by Eleanor Roosevelt about the plight of African Americans. In 1951, the couple moved to Indianapolis. Jones attended Indiana University for 2 years and then took night classes at Butler University, earning a degree in secondary education in 1961, 10 years after enrolling. In 1951, 20-year-old Jones began attending gatherings at the of the Communist Party USA in Indianapolis. He became flustered with harassment during the McCarthy hearings, particularly regarding an event that he attended with his mother focusing on Paul Robeson, after which she was harassed by the FBI in front of her co-workers for attending. He also became frustrated with the persecution of open and accused communists in the United States, especially during the trials of Julius and Ethel Rosenberg. Jones said he asked himself, "How can I demonstrate my Marxism?" The thought was, infiltrate the church. Jones was surprised when a Methodist district superintendent helped him get a start in the church, even though he knew Jones to be a communist. In 1952, he became a student pastor at Somerset Southside Methodist Church, but later claimed he left the church because its leaders barred him from integrating blacks into the congregation. Around this time, Jones witnessed a faith healing service at a seven-day Baptist church. He observed that it attracted people and their money, and he concluded that he could accomplish his social goals with financial resources from such services. Jones organized a mammoth religious convention to take place June 11th through the 15th, 1956, in Cadle Tabernacle. He needed a well-known religious figure to draw crowds, so he arranged to share the pulpit with Reverend William M. Branham, a healing evangelist and religious author who was as highly revered as Oral Roberts at the time. Jones was able to launch his own church following the convention, which had various names until it became the People's Temple Christian Church Full Gospel. The People's Temple was initially an interracial mission. Jones was known to regularly study Adolf Hitler and Father Divine to learn how to manipulate members of the cult. Divine told Jones personally to find an enemy, to make sure they know who the enemy is, and it will unify those in the group and make them subservient to him. The New York Times reported that in 1953, declaring that he was outraged at what he perceived as racial discrimination in his white congregation, Mr. Jones established his own church and poignantly opened it to all ethnic groups. To raise money, he imported monkeys and sold them door to door as pets. In 1960, Indianapolis Mayor Charles Boswell appointed Jones director of the local Human Rights Commission. Jones ignored Boswell's advice to keep a low profile. However, finding new outlets for his views on local radio and television programs, the mayor and other commissioners asked him to curtail his public actions, but he resisted. He was wildly cheered at the meeting of NAACP and Urban League when he yelled for his audience to be more militant. They claimed with "Let my people go." During this time, Jones also helped to racially integrate churches, restaurants, and the telephone company, the Indianapolis Police Department, a theater, an amusement park, and the Indiana University Health Methodist Hospital. Swastikas were painted on the homes of two black families, and Jones walked through the neighborhood, comforting local black people and counseling white families not to move. He set up sting operations to catch restaurants refusing to serve black customers and wrote to American Nazi leaders and then passed their responses to the media. He was accidentally placed in the black ward of a hospital after a collapse in 1961, and he refused to be moved. He began to make the beds and empty the bedpans of black patients. Political pressure resulting from Jones's actions caused hospital officials to desegregate the wards. Jones received considerable criticism in Indiana for his integrationalist views. White-owned businesses and locals were critical of him. A swastika was placed on the temple, a stick of dynamite was left in a temple coal pile, and a dead cat was thrown at Jones's house after a threatening phone call. Other incidents occurred, but one could theorize that Jones himself was involved in at least some of them. Jones and his wife adopted several non-white children. He referred to his household as his rainbow family and stated, "Integration is a more personal thing than thing with me now. It's a question of my son's future." He also portrayed the temple as a rainbow family. So, at the beginning of this guy's career or story in the public, it's that of an activist. It's not the guy that I guess a lot of people would have suspected for it to end the way that it did. Although some did know his interest and ties into communism and things of that nature, I guess more people at that beginning saw more good than bad and saw him more as a person with a strong opinion that maybe can get some things done and get some integration going on and more acceptance in a good way versus bad, which I find very interesting of this character, because what he ends up being known for, ultimately is how things ended in a very horrible way. But we most of the time don't really understand the beginning of how this all started and how what may be good can turn into something very, very bad.
What is so interesting about that statement is you look at modern day politics, or politics in any generation, the beginning is you have an initial thought, there's a problem, here's how I can fix it. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, there's 10 million people that have a problem that they believe they can fix it. Sadly, when you push through and you gain the acceptance and you become a ruler and such, it's very difficult to stay as pure of that initial beginning.
Yeah.
And sadly, whether it's having to do deals or have people that maybe you don't particularly agree with their viewpoints, but they can back you up, you then have to change a little bit. There has to be a shift.
Yeah.
And it sounds as though this is exactly what happened. The initial, for the betterment, in a positive, something went clearly off path. There was an exit ramp that was taken.
Yeah.
And he just hammered down the gas and kept on going. There was no positivity coming back.
It's one of those things where once the whole story is told and we have it all in front of us and you can kind of unpack it, you can kind of see some of the off ramps and how they were taken in a more clear way than just when you're kind of going through it and go, oh, so that was done for this. We can already kind of see it here where he realizes, oh, creating religious type gatherings is a great way to fund his ideas. Whether he agrees with the religious aspects or not, it's a way to get money. And there's clearly a lot of manipulation and a lot of, you know, there's a man behind the curtain here more than just what people were seeing out there in public. So let's continue on with the story of Jim Jones here on the Dark Side of Wikipedia. The couple adopted three Korean-American children named Lou, Suzanne, and Stephanie, and he encouraged temple members to adopt orphans from war-ravaged Korea. He also was critical of U.S. adoptions to communist leader Kim Il-sung's 1950 invasion of South Korea, calling it the War of Liberation, stating that South Korea is a living example of all that socialism in the North has overcome. In 1954, he and his wife also adopted Agnes, who was part American Indian. Suzanne was adopted at the age of 6 in 1959. In June 1959, the couple had their only biological daughter, whom they named Stephen Gandhi. They became the first white couple in Indiana to adopt a black child. They also adopted a son who was named Tim. Tim's birth mother was a member of the People's Temple, and he was originally named Timothy Glenn Tupper. Jones traveled with his family to Belo Horizonte, Brazil, with the idea of setting up a new temple location after preaching at the temple about the fears of a nuclear holocaust and reading an article in the January 1962 issue of Esquire magazine, which listed the city as a safe place in nuclear war. On his way to Brazil, he made his first trip to Guinea, a British colony at the time. The family rented a modest three-bedroom home in Belo Horizonte. Jones studied the local economy and receptiveness of racial minorities to his message, although language remained a barrier. He also explored local Brazilian Cisternistic religions. He was careful not to portray himself as a communist in a foreign territory and spoke of an apostolic communal lifestyle rather than of Castro or Marx. Ultimately, the lack of resources in the local led them to move to Rio de Janeiro in mid-1963, where they worked with the poor in the slums. Jones became plagued by guilt for leaving behind the Indiana civil rights struggle and possibly losing what he had tried to build there. His associate preachers in Indiana told him the temple was about to collapse without him, so he returned. Jones returned from Brazil in December of 1963 and told his Indiana congregation the world would be engulfed by nuclear war on July 15, 1967, leading to a new socialist Eden on Earth, and that the temple had to move to Northern California for safety. Accordingly, the temple began moving to Redwood Valley, California, near the city of Yucca. According to religious studies professor Catherine Wessinger, Jones always spoke of the social gospel's virtues, but he chose to conceal that his gospel was actually communism until the late 1960s. By that time, he began partially revealing the details of his socialism concept in temple sermons. He also thought that those who remained drugged with the opiate of religion had to be brought to enlightenment, which was socialism. He often mixed these ideas, such as preaching that if you're born a capitalist in America, racist America, fascist America, then you're born in sin. But if you're born in socialism, you're not born in sin. By the early 1970s, Jones began deriding Christianity as fly away religion, rejecting the Bible as being a tool to oppress women and non-whites, and denouncing a sky god who was no god at all. He wrote a booklet titled The Letter Killeth, criticizing the King James Bible. Jones also began preaching that he was the reincarnation of Gandhi, Mother Divine, Jesus, Buddha, Vladimir Lenin. Former temple member Hugh Forston Jr. quoted him as saying, "What you need to believe in is what you can see. If you see me as your friend, I'll be your friend. If you see me as your father, I'll be your father. For those of you that don't have a father, if you see me as your savior, I'll be your savior. If you see me as your God, I'll be your God." In a 1976 phone conversation with John Maher, Jones alternatively said that he was an agnostic and atheist. Marceline Jones admitted in a 1977 New York Times interview that Jones was trying to promote Marxism in the U.S. by mobilizing people through religion, citing Mao as his inspiration. She stated, "Jim used religion to try to get some people out of the opiate of religion. He had slammed the Bible on the table, yelling, 'I've got to destroy this paper idol.' In one sermon, Jones said, 'You're going to help yourself or you're going to get no help. There's no one hope of glory that's within you. Nobody's going to come out of the sky. There's no heaven up there. We'll have to make heaven down here.'" Within 5 years of moving to California, the temple experienced a period of exponential growth and opened branches in cities including San Fernando, San Francisco, and Los Angeles. By the early 1970s, Jones began shifting his focus to major cities because of limited expansion opportunities in California. He eventually moved the temple's headquarters to San Francisco, which was a major center for radical protest movements, and both Jones and the temple became influential in the San Francisco politics scene, culminating in the temple's instrumental role in George Moscone's mayoral victory in 1975. Moscone subsequently appointed Jones as the chairman of the San Francisco Housing Authority Commission. Jones was able to gain contact with prominent politicians at the local and national level. For example, he and Moscone met privately with vice presidential candidate Walter Mondale on his campaign plain days before the 1976 election, leading Mondale to publicly praise the temple. First Lady Rosalynn Carter also met with Jones on multiple occasions, corresponded with him about Cuba, and spoke with him at the grand opening of the San Francisco headquarters, where he received louder applause than she did. In September of 1976, California Assemblyman Willie Brown served as master of ceremonies at a large testimonial dinner for Jones, attended by Governor Jerry Brown, and Lieutenant Governor Mervyn DeMalley. At that dinner, Brown touted Jones as what you should see every day when you look in the mirror, and said he was a combination of Martin Luther King Jr., Angela Davis, Albert Einstein, and Mao. Harvey Milk spoke to audiences during political rallies held at the temple, and he wrote to Jones after one such visit, "Reverend Jim, it may take me many a day to come back down from the high that I reached today. I found something dear today. I found a sense of being that makes up for all the hours and energy placed in a fight. I found what you wanted me to find. I shall be back, for I can never leave." Jones hosted local political figures at his San Francisco apartment for discussions, including Davis. He spoke with publisher Carlton Goodlett of the San Francisco Sun-Reporter about his remorse over not being able to travel to socialist countries such as People's Republic of China and the Soviet Union, speculating that he could be chief dairyman of the USSR. His criticisms led to increased tensions with the Nation of Islam, so Jones spoke at a huge rally in the Los Angeles Convention Center that was attended by many of his closest political acquaintances, hoping to close the rift between the two groups. Jones also forged alliances with key columnists and others at the San Francisco Chronicle and other press outlets. Although the move to San Francisco also brought increasing media scrutiny, Chronicle reporter Marshall Kilduff encountered resistance to publishing an expose, so he brought his story to New West magazine. In the summer of 1977, Jones and several hundred temple members abruptly decided to move to the temple's compound in Africa, after they learned the contents of Kilduff's article, which included allegations by former temple members that they were physically, emotionally, and sexually abused. Jones named the settlement Jonestown after himself. Jones had started building Jonestown, formerly known as the People's Temple Agricultural Project, several years before the New West article was published. It was promoted as a means to create both a socialist paradise and a sanctuary from the media scrutiny in San Francisco. Jones purported to establish it as a model communist community, adding that the temple comprised the purest communists there are. He did not, however, permit members to leave Jonestown. Religious scholar Mary McCormick Maga argues that Jones's authority decreased after he moved to the isolated commune because he was not needed for recruitment and he could not hide his drug addiction from rank-and-file members. In spite of the allegations prior to Jones's departure, he was still respected by some for setting up a racially mixed church, which helped the disadvantaged. 68% of Jonestown's residents were black. Jones started to propagate his belief in what he termed translation. Once they were in Jonestown, where he and his followers would all die together and move to another planet and live blissfully. And so the crazy begins. Where you start talking about moving to another planet and living blissfully, but you got to come here first to go to the other planet. That's where shit gets weird. And that's where, yeah, you know, you got to go, "I think I'm out." But, you know, that's how some of this stuff works. That's how brainwashing works. You, from a distance, you can look at this and go, how on earth did people follow this person? You know, as it gets crazier and crazier, but that's how, because it starts out as crazy light. And then it just slowly gets into the full-fledged, you're just drinking the fucking syrup. It's no longer even like full caffeine. It's now we're not even adding water to this shit anymore. You're just drinking the syrup of the soda and you don't know the difference because we've just slowly been changing this for you. And I think we see some of that today. You know, it's always gone on in history. And I think a lot of times we look back at history and go, how did massive groups of people that otherwise seem to be somewhat sane end up following such crazy ideology? It's like, oh, well, there you go.
Yeah, it starts out as a Flavor Aid. You want to save $20. Next thing you know, there's a picture of a fruity substance, yeah, breaking through brick walls saying, oh, yeah. And that's the thing. That's Mr. Kool-Aid, by the way, if you don't get that reference, much like I didn't get the What About Bob reference earlier in the program, is baby steps.
Yeah.
You slowly start to, it's like peeling an onion. You can't just chop it right in half. You're gonna kill the whole pitch. You slowly, methodically. I thought this was a great business venture up until the last sentence of, "Hey, let's move to another planet and live blissfully." By then, you're addicted. By then, you are a soldier. By then, you are locked and loaded with this gentleman. And then he just, it's like catnip for all of these followers.
Yeah. It's interesting, you know, it being a mass suicide. I mean, you look at other things in more recent history. We haven't really had a lot of them. I mean, Waco was more so a mass, you know, invasion and murder that wasn't necessarily an intentional suicide. But when you look at Heaven's Gate, that would have been, I think, one of the more recent that had gone on, which is now 20 years ago. Do you remember Heaven's Gate? That was like the late 90s.
I do. I remember watching it on the news. I got to tell you, my mental Rolodex of militias and cults is not deep.
Yeah,
I was lying on a leather couch somewhere, and somebody in glasses holding a notepad to tell me to purposely forget about that.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't.
That was the guy. And I think the only reason I remember him is because it was internet based. They have a website. I think the website is still there, and I think some members still actually updated that did not die. And they still believe in this preaching or this cause, because and I don't have it all in front of me, that's for another episode, but in a very small context, it was the comet Hale-Bopp they believed was coming over Earth, and that it was going to take them up into the sky, but first they had to all, I don't know if it was Kool-Aid or Flavor-Aid or something, but they did something and then they all died. And the guy, I remember, he had the crazy videos that were being showed. And he looked he looked the role of a crazy person. He didn't look like somewhat like, oh, this looks like he could possibly be a businessman. No, this looked like the strange man that's standing outside the airport that's, you know, trying to sell you used condoms. It was kind of bizarre. But that was, I think, one of the more recent. We haven't had a mass cult suicide, as far as I'm aware. We're due. I think that's the point. I think we're due almost, which is a horrible thing to say. But if you look at history, like every 15, 20 years or so, you tend to get one. Maybe there's been one in some other country that I'm just not aware of that we've never seen in our press here. But let's continue that on. What's that?
I was just going to say that was right around the time on the internet where there was the dancing baby.
Yeah, exactly.
So I remember dancing baby and Marshall Applewhite.
So what was Marshall Applewhite? Marshall Applewhite. Was that his name?
That's the guy.
Okay. I forgot what his name was. Yeah. Okay. Marshall Applewhite. Yes. Ally McBeal would have been on television at the time. So that's how far back we go. And people thought Vonda Shepard was a great musical artist, which I still don't understand to this day. Continuing on with this story. Jones claimed he was the biological father of John Victor Stowen, although the birth certificate listed Temple attorney Timothy Stowen and his wife Grace as the parents of the child. The Temple repeatedly claimed that Jones fathered the child in 1971 when Stowen had requested that Jones have sex with Grace to keep her from defecting. Grace left the Temple in 1976 and began divorce proceedings the following year. Jones ordered Tim to take the boy to the cult in February of 1977 in order to avoid a custody dispute with Grace. After Tim himself defected in June of 1977, the Temple kept John Stowen in Jonestown. He also fathered Jim John with Temple member Carolyn Larice Moore Layton. In the autumn of 1977, Tim Stowen and others who had left the Temple formed a concerned relatives group because they had family members in Jonestown. Stowen traveled to Washington, D.C. in January 1978 to visit with State Department officials and members of Congress, and he wrote a white paper detailing his grievances against Jones and the Temple. His efforts aroused the curiosity of California Congressman Leo Ryan, who wrote a letter to Stowen's behalf to the prime minister of the Guyanese area, Forbes Berman. The concerned relatives also began a legal battle with the temple over the custody of Stone's son, John. Most of Jones' political allies broke ties after his departure, although some did not. Willie Brown spoke out against enemies at a rally that was attended by Harvey Milk and Assemblyman Art Angos. On February 19, 1978, Milk wrote a letter to President Jimmy Carter defending Jones as a man of the highest character, and he claimed that escaped temple members were trying to damage Reverend Jones's reputation with apparent bold-faced lies. Moscone's office issued a press release saying Jones had broken no laws. On April 11, 1978, the concerned relatives distributed a packet of documents, letters, and affidavits to the People's Temple, members of the press, and members of Congress, which they titled An Accusation of Human Rights Violations by Reverend James Warren Jones. In June 1978, escaped temple member Deborah Layton provided the group with a further affidavit detailing crimes by the temple and substandard living conditions in Jonestown. Jones was facing increasing scrutiny in the summer of 1978 when he hired JFK assassination conspiracy theorist Mark Lane and Donald Freed to help make the case of a grand conspiracy against the temple by U.S. intelligence agencies. Jones told Lane he wanted to pull an Eldridge Cleaver, referring to a fugitive member of the Black Panthers who was able to return to the U.S. after repairing his reputation. In November of 1978, Leo Ryan led a fact-finding mission to Jonestown to investigate allegations of human rights abuses. His delegation included relatives of temple members, an NBC camera crew, and reporters for various newspapers. The group arrived in the Guyanese capital of Georgetown on November 15th. 2 days later, they traveled by airplane to Port Katuma, where they were transported to the Jonestown encampment in a limousine. Jones hosted a reception for the delegation that evening at the Central Pavilion in Jonestown. The delegation left hurriedly the afternoon of November 18th after temple member Don Sly attacked Ryan with a knife. Although the attack was thwarted, Ryan and his delegation managed to take along 15 temple members who had expressed a wish to leave. Jones made no attempt to prevent their departure at that time. As members of the delegation boarded two planes at the airstrip, Jones' armed guards called the Red Brigade arrived on a tractor and trailer and began shooting at them. The gunman killed Ryan and four others near the Guyan Airways Twin Otter aircraft. At the same time, one of the supposed defectors, Larry Layton, drew a weapon and began firing on members of the party who had already boarded a small Cessna. An NBC cameraman was able to capture footage of the first few seconds of the shooting at the Otter. The five killed at the airstrip were Ryan, NBC reporter Don Harris, NBC cameraman Bob Brown, San Francisco Examiner photographer Greg Robinson, and temple member Patricia Parks. Surviving the attack were future Congresswoman Jackie Speer, then a staff member for Ryan, Richard Dreyer, the deputy chief of mission for the U.S. Embassy at Georgetown, Bob Flick, a producer for NBC, Steve Sung, an NBC sound engineer, Tim Reitman, a San Francisco Examiner reporter, Ron Javiers, a San Francisco Chronicle reporter, Charles Krause, a Washington Post reporter, and several defecting temple members. Later that same day, 909 inhabitants of Jonestown, 304 of them children, died of apparent cyanide poisoning, mostly in and around the settlement's main pavilion. This resulted in the greatest single loss of American civilian life, murder plus suicide, though not on American soil, in a deliberate act up until the September 11th attacks. The FBI later recovered a 45-minute audio recording of the suicide in progress. On that tape, Jones tells temple members that the Soviet Union, with whom the temple had been negotiating a potential exodus for months, would not take them after the airstrip murders. The reason given by Jones to commit suicide was consistent with his previously stated conspiracy theories of intelligence organizations allegedly conspiring against the temple, that men would parachute in here on us, shoot some of our innocent babies, and they'll torture our children. They'll torture some of our people here. They'll torture our seniors. Jones's prior statements that hostile forces would convert captured children to fascism would lead many members who had held strong opposing views to fascism to view the suicide as valid. With that reasoning, Jones and several members argued that the group should commit revolutionary suicide by drinking cyanide-laced grape-flavored Flavor-Aide. Later released Temple films show Jones opening a storage container full of Kool-Aid in large quantities. However, empty packets of grape Flavor-Aide found on the scene show that this is what was used to mix the solution, along with a sedative. One member, Christine Miller, dissents towards the beginning of the tape. When members apparently cried, Jones counseled, "Stop these hysterics. This is not the way for people who are socialists or communists to die. No way for us to die. We must die with some dignity." Jones can be heard saying, "Don't be afraid to die. That death is just stepping over into another plane and that it's a friend." At the end of the tape, Jones concludes, "We didn't commit suicide. We committed an act of revolutionary suicide, protesting the conditions of an inhumane world." According to escaping Temple members, children were given the drink first by their own parents. Families were told to lie down together. Mass suicide had been previously discussed in simulated events called White Nights on a regular basis. During at least one such prior White Night, members drank liquid that Jones falsely told them was poison. Following the mass murder-suicide, Jones was found dead on the floor. He was resting on a pillow near his deck chair with a gunshot wound to his head, which Guyanese coroner said was consistent with suicide. His body was later dragged outside for examination and embalming. The official autopsy conducted in December of 1978 also confirms his death as suicide. Jones's son, Stephen, believes his father may have directed someone else to shoot him, but that is speculation. An autopsy of Jones's body also showed levels of the barbiturate pentobarbital, which may have been lethal to humans who had not developed physiological tolerance. A sign could be seen hanging above Jones's deck chair. Jones had borrowed a quote from George Santayana, "Those who do not remember the past are condemned to repeat it." Jones married Marceline Baldwin in 1949. He began his first affair in 1968 with a woman named Carolyn Layton, whom he was with until the end. Another woman he became closest to was Maria Katsaris. Their relationship began in 1974, and she was also one of his mistresses until the end. He also had many other mistresses during the 1970s, both before the move to Jonestown and while living in Jonestown. The book The Road to Jonestown by Jeff Ginn states Jones had occasional sex with male followers, but never as often as he did with women. It states he was most likely bisexual, but his main physical and sexual attraction was towards women. On December 13, 1973, Jones was arrested and charged with lewd conduct for masturbating in a movie theater restroom near MacArthur Park in Los Angeles. The decoy was an undercover LAPD vice officer. Jones is on record as later telling his followers he was the only true heterosexual. While Jones banned sex among Temple members outside marriage, he ferociously engaged in sexual relations with both male and female Temple members. Jones, however, claimed that he detested engaging in homosexual activity and did so only for the male Temple members' adherents' own good, purportedly to connect them symbolically with him. The International Peace Mission Movement leader, Father Divine, was one of Jones' sources of inspiration. So there you go. A whole lot of interesting in terms of being contradictory to his own beliefs. I mean, this is truly someone, if you really look into it, someone who's probably a crazy narcissistic personality disorder and a whole handful of other things in there as well, where he's able to literally believe, you know, his own insanity, but powerful enough to deliver the message to others and make others believe in his own cause as well. That convincing, that compelling of an individual.
What I got from this is, growing up, I never enjoyed grape Kool-Aid.
There's a reason for that.
I tell you what, all these years later, there was a reason. There was a reason that I didn't like grape Kool-Aid. I don't even know. I also know if I'm ever going to consult a law firm, mm-hmm. I am going to consult Burnham, Milk, and Cleaver. Because, man, Forbes Burnham, Harvey Milk, and Eldridge Cleaver. I don't care what I'm charged with. They will win. They will represent me and kick ass.
It may be different members by now. It may not be the same folks. In fact, I know it's not
this
the same.
This guy, we talked about baby steps earlier in the recording. This final part of how this all went down.
Yeah.
I mean, all the people that we spotlight on the dark sides of Wikipedia, there is calculation, there are baby steps, but this guy takes the cake.
Yeah.
All of this happened in such a short amount of time, mm-hmm. and the most normal thing that he did is got arrested for lewd conduct at a movie theater.
Yeah. What I find interesting is he had both stashes of Flavor-Aid and Kool-Aid. So it wasn't like he didn't have the Kool-Aid.
He's like, I bought the more expensive brand and I saved a few bucks. Let's use the cheaper shit.
When you're going to die, why not go for the high-end stuff? Why are you, when you're going to die, when you're killing off everybody in mass suicide, why are you going for the off-brand? Why are you not using the Kool-Aid that's clearly there? Was it
if it
doesn't expire. Fuck, I have like Kool-Aid from 1987 in my cupboard. I'll mix that shit up and it tastes like 1987 all over again. Sharkleberry Finn, here I come. But it's crazy. All the things they're arguing about is why did he not use Kool-Aid over Flavor-Aid? But it's a valid question.
And if you think to yourself, if you're putting together this brew that is lethal,
yeah.
you don't want to use expired Kool-Aid. You'd rather use the fresh Flavor-Aid.
Yeah. It doesn't expire. I don't think it expires.
I just want to go make some Sharkleberry Fins, I don't know about you, but lime. Lime mm-hmm. was, if you were over at a friend's house for dinner and they had lime Kool-Aid,
yeah.
you were high class. You were highbrow. Sharkleberry Finn, fruit punch. That was more of your standard affair. But
now,
lime?
No, lime was you could get lime anytime you wanted. Sharkleberry Finn was a seasonal option from Kool-Aid. It was like every summer they'd come out with a new flavor. And one of the summer flavors in like 1991 or something was Sharkleberry Finn. And I absolutely loved, lime was normally my favorite, but then Sharkleberry Finn, that became my new favorite. And what's really funny about Sharkleberry Finn is it was seasonal and they did kept bringing it back. They brought it back for several summers in the 90s. And then it kind of just it went away. And Kool-Aid, for a lot of it, it was hard to find Kool-Aid in the little packets. Now you can find it again. But what I find interesting, and I kind of joke with Jen about this, is about 8 years ago, when we started doing the podcast Real Ghost Stories Online, I started talking about Sharkleberry Finn on the air, just making references to it. And I could not find it in the stores anywhere. I looked it up online and you could find people selling it on eBay, like old packets of it that they had in their cupboard for like 10 bucks a packet. But it was not available in the stores. But shortly after I started talking about it on the air, I started seeing it in the stores again. So I don't know. I don't know if I had any influence in bringing Sharkleberry Finn back to the world. Or people going, yeah, that was a good flavor. Let's bring that shit back. But I go into any Walmart nowadays and there's like lime, grape, fruit punch. And the only childhood seasonal flavor that exists in 2020, Sharkleberry Finn. So,
are you getting paid by the Kool-Aid company?
I'm not.
Are you?
I'm not. But I think in one of those things, in my Wikipedia entry, when I'm dead someday, and it's like accomplishments. It's like was a strong influencer in bringing Sharkleberry Finn back to life. I think will be one of the little sections.
Mic drop.
Yeah, right there. It'll have its own thing. It'll just be like life, family, ghost stories, Sharkleberry Finn, death. That's going to be
in the other where there's asterisks and footnotes. By the way, if you're listening to this, which this will probably be 6 weeks after we record this, you can get 192 packets, 192 packets, 0.16 ounce packets of Kool-Aid, Sharkleberry Finn right now for $48 on Amazon.
That's a steal. That is right there. That's the deal of the day, everybody. It's almost like selling coronavirus cures like Jim Jones in Branson. Or not Jim Jones. Like, what's his name? I associate these people together, even though they're very different. Who's the crazy preacher in Branson that was trying to sell the coronavirus cures?
The ShamWow guy?
No. Him and his wife did all the ministry stuff, and then he went to jail for a while. Jim Baker, both Jims, Jim Baker. But he was was told by the government, you can't tell people you have a cure for coronavirus and sell it in your religious programs. Jim Baker, one of the characters who, quite honestly, this is just an opinion of mine. Quite honestly, I'm surprised has not ended up going down one of these paths like this. After all the shit that he's, you know, gone through and had, and the following that he had, and all the shit that fell out, and how he has somehow been able to reestablish himself as some semi-legitimate religious figure to some people in the world and in the Branson area, is scary to me.
Yet. Let me tell you why he hasn't gone down this path. Yes.
I mean, he sits there and he hawks, you know, all sorts of stuff that is, you know, essentially survivalist gear. Okay. But then he was doing something about coronavirus. I don't know what it was. I don't know if he said he had the cure or if he said that this product was something to the effect of like it may be able to or it can. Or anyway, it was insinuated in some way, shape or form that brought attention. And they said, you can't fucking say that.
The most important question, really, throughout this entire program, you have Flavor Aid, you have Kool-Aid.
Yeah.
What is the relation then to Hawaiian Punch?
It's in its own ecosystem. It's its own universe. I viewed it as more in the soda family than I did the... wasn't Hawaiian Punch carbonated somewhat or not?
Hawaiian Punch, well, it's a funny question you asked, Tony, because it is a brand of fruit punch containing 5% fruit juice.
Yeah.
So of the 100% of it, 5% is fruit juice.
Yeah.
And I'm going to have to put you on hold for ingredients if it's carbonated or not.
I know they sell it like in jugs, so that makes me think it's not carbonated, although I don't know. But I remember, I know you love baseball. I could give a shit about baseball. But as a kid, my dad made me play Little League for a couple years, and I'm horrible at it.
In the batter's box.
Hustle up. I perpetually played right field because the ball rarely went there. And I couldn't catch the ball. I maybe could hit the ball sometimes. It was so boring to me. It just is not my thing. But the only reason I would go was because at the end of each game, you know, one of the moms, it was a rotating thing. You brought the cooler of stuff, and quite frequently it was cans of Hawaiian Punch. That's why I'm wondering if it was carbonated, because I remember opening up cans of Hawaiian Punch. But
it,
I don't
shows
know.
Here, there is a, it's a syrup based, started out in 1934 as an ice cream topping syrup.
No shit.
In a converted garage in Fullerton, California, A.W. Leo, Tom Yeats, and Ralph Harrison, fast forward, it was purchased, their company, by R.J. Reynolds Tobacco Company in 1962. It then later transferred to its newly acquired Del Monte subsidiary, which I believe also makes a bunch of fruits, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Cans. Fast forward to Procter & Gamble.
Not caffeinated is the answer. Not caffeinated is the answer.
Fast forward all the way to what's currently owned by the Dr. Pepper Snapple Company.
Mm-hmm.
And then they merged with Keurig. Holy hell.
It's caffeine and carbonation free is what, and it gives you 100% daily value of your vitamin C when you Google it. That's what it says. So I guess you get your corn syrup and your vitamin C simultaneously. So,
Wow.
There you go. Well, we should just do a whole episode of The Dark Side of Wikipedia on Hawaiian Punch, of people who had it fed to them and their parents thought it was juice.
An IV. IVs of Hawaiian Punch, unbeknownst in nurseries across the country.
Give them some juice. It's Hawaiian Punch. It's got to be good for them. It's just as good as orange juice. Yeah, there you go. That's going to wrap up The Dark Side of Wikipedia today as we talk about Jim Jones. Thank you guys for listening. Be sure to press subscribe whatever platform it is you listen to us on. We greatly appreciate that. Leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. It helps us grow in the rankings and lets other folks know that we exist. Until next time, for The Dark Side of Wikipedia, for Sean, I'm Tony. Thanks for listening.